You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Dorneth Doherty. She's calling from Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Dorneth, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd. I'm looking forward to this.
Let's talk about what you're working on in your studio right now. I know you're a Guggenheim Foundation Fellow not long ago, I think in 2012, for different projects, and we could talk about some of what you were working on then and you've been working on widely throughout throughout the world, really. But what is it that you're working on right now to get into what's happening in your studio, if that's appropriate there?
Well, I'm actually still working on my Guggenheim project. It's a very long-term project that's taken me 8 or 9 years to complete. And it's a project that looks at the spaces and technological interventions surrounding seed banking.
So tell me a little bit about that as a project and how it was proposed. Tell me a little bit about seed banking and what that means. I know some of it and a little bit about what's happening in Norway, but just for the listeners, how did that project start, and what are you exactly doing in terms of that topic?
So when I started the project, I was inspired by an article I read in The New Yorker written by John Seabrook called Sowing for the Apocalypse. And at that time, it was about the opening of the seed bank, the Svalbard Glivold Seed Vault, that's only 600 miles from the North Pole. That's the one that you mentioned in Norway. And I didn't know what a seed bank was at the time. And I was amazed by this heroic project that was at one point it was pessimistic, and then on the other side it's super optimistic because you have volunteers and institutions that are collaborating to preserve biodiversity of our plant life. And then on the other hand, you have the gravity of climate change and political instability that's created the need for a doomsday vault on a remote island near the North Pole.
So explain that a little bit more, just to clarify for any listeners who don't know exactly what a seed vault is. This seed vault was created and houses what seeds for what purpose?
So the Svalbard Vault, there's actually 1,400 seed banks in the world. And the Svalbard Global Seed Vault is perhaps the most famous for the layperson. And what the idea behind that vault is basically like a Noah's Ark. There was a gentleman named Cary Fowler who spent 35 years trying to establish this seed vault. And it's an international effort by scientists and governments to bring the seeds that are native to their country or that are economically viable, usually meaning agricultural seeds, and make a collection and store a backup collection of their seeds so that if something happens in their national seed bank, there will be a backup copy. So in many countries where there's civil strife or environmental disasters, this seed bank becomes a backup collection that they can go to that's remote and safe from those kinds of catastrophes.
And so in the event of a catastrophe, these seeds presumably would be used to bring sustaining food and life back into land that was destroyed. Is that essentially the premise?
Yes. That's exactly what it is. And the seed banks around the world that this expanded from that point, and I ended up traveling over four continents and to almost 20 seed banks. And in the country, in the national seed banks, many times they will have research related to improving food or creating biofuels or industrial applications for the plants. But the Svalbard vault is unique in that it's really just a backup collection. It's deep inside a cave that's drilled into the side of a mountain, and the mountain is so tall that if both polar ice caps melt, the seeds will remain above the waterline. And by being deep in a cave, they're below the permafrost line, and they'll remain frozen and viable for 200 years or more. So for me, the notion that here's this, you know, effort to create a state of suspended animation in plants in order to preserve biodiversity, and just how serious our present situation is that's created this need. But, you know, the other part that fascinates me is the fact that you can't really stop time in living materials, no matter how much we want to. And just to see the kind of research and efforts among all these various far-flung scientists, you know, collaborating across, you know, they work in remote locations, and then they share resources and, you know, seeds and research in an effort to create this pretty utopian ideal of saving the world, plant life.
Right. And I mean, it's utopian, but it's also, of course, apocalyptic, right? It's a kind of very last resort.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell me about the dichotomy. And it's wonderful and horrible, right? I mean, that's all there. So tell me a little bit about the Guggenheim proposal and what that was, what you set out to do and are still doing in relation to the seed bank.
Well, so it's a little bit complicated. The project that I'm pursuing with the seed banks is a dual project. On one side, I'm making kind of insistently descriptive photographs with a large format, originally with a large format camera, and now with a, you know, kind of stitching software and a high-end DSLR. And on the other side, I'm using the X-ray machines that the scientists use in the various banks to do statistical analysis of the seed viability, and I'm making x-rays of the materials stored in the collections and then creating digital collages from those x-rays. So there's the two projects are linked because they're made at the same time and the same place usually, and then I take the digital x-rays back to my studio to make the collages because they're super painstaking and they take forever to make.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Okay. Keep going. If you want to tell more about the projects, I want to hear more about the collage process, but go on. So then what continues to happen? What's the rest of the process?
So the rest of the process or the Guggenheim? So I have this dual process.
The Guggenheim. Yeah, okay. Let's not talk about the collage process yet. So and I want to talk about that, but just the rest of the Guggenheim project.
So the Guggenheim, at the time that I wrote for the Guggenheim, I had already photographed on many U.S. and British banks, and I had applied to go to a super historically important bank that is the Vavilov. The Nikolai Vavilov Institute. So my Guggenheim project, my proposal involved going to three banks that I hadn't had the resources to go to. And one was located in Russia. It was in St. Petersburg, Russia, and it's the Vavilov Institute for Plant Industry. And the main bank for Russia is this bank, and it's located in St. Petersburg. It has amazing history, which I'll go into in a second. The second bank I wanted to go to was in Brazil, and specifically what I was looking at in Brazil is that there is a blight that is affecting bananas, and it is like the potato blight, and the Lord Cavendish banana that we eat today, that's the common banana that we all you get at the grocery store, is predicted to go extinct. So they are key in the research for the replacement banana for the Lord Cavendish. And then the third place I wanted to go to for the Guggenheim, with the Guggenheim support, is Australia. And I ended up going to three seed banks in Australia that were only somewhat related. And the reason I wanted to go there is I had read about the Wallamai pine, which was a plant that was thought to be extinct. It was it flourished at the time of the dinosaurs, and they thought it was completely wiped out, but they found a remnant population several decades ago and kept it secret until they could breed enough of them to preserve the species. So it was a tiny, tiny population that somehow managed to survive all those years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
So, yeah.
So this is part of the research that you're doing, right? This is you're saying what you're using the grant from is also to travel and get images and do research. Like what exactly was happening at these places?
So the proposal was that I wanted to go and photograph this in the same manner that I've been photographing before, which was to make documentary or descriptive photographs of the spaces and technological interventions and the kind of technology that is used to preserve seeds and the seed banks themselves. Because you can't get in, it's not a tourist spot. You can't go visit a seed bank. And so using it in the way that 19th century photography was used in a kind of an expeditionary way, where photography frequently is used to allow people visual access to a remote or secure location that you couldn't see otherwise. I mean, if you think about the moon, you know, they sent, in addition to bringing rocks back, they brought photographs so that people could have the sense that they had seen what the surface of the moon was like, or the 19th century photography where they would send people across. So I was doing the photographs of the spaces and also making x-rays of the seeds and research plants in these collections while I was at these various banks.
I see. Okay. So that part has been done. What happened so far? And I want to talk a little bit about the process, but what have you done so far?
So now I'm wrapping up the project. I just was in Germany last week to supervise the printing of the monograph of the project. I'll have a solo show at the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth that opens in August, and I'll be up through January. So I'm really wrapping up the project right now. But
So that's very exciting. So starting stuff. So the wrapping up the project will be the book about much of what we've talked about in more detail, of course, and it'll also be these images, these collages that you created. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay.
And the,
you can go on to what you were saying or tell me exactly what the process is, that kind of complicated process you were talking about for making the collage, the steps involved there.
Well, the collages themselves are time-consuming and painstaking, although for anybody who uses digital photography, it's not particularly difficult. It's just super time-consuming because many times the collages deal with, for instance, the massive numbers of tiny, tiny seeds that it takes to save a species. It takes 5,000 seeds to save a species. So, for instance, I will x-ray 5,000 seeds, and then there are these really kind of raw digital files that are okay for scientific use but need cleaning up, and the seeds themselves have to be removed from the background, and then they're, you know, carefully placed in grids or on another canvas that are quite large. It talks about that notion of the tension between the tiny, tiny seeds and the ginormous number of materials that you need to keep to save a species.
Right. Wow. So then, what do you do with these? So these images are then. What's next? Do you do? How do they get ready for presentation? What's the final?
Well, they're printed, and then some of them they're presented in a variety of ways, but. For the most part, they exist as either black and white or grayscale images, or blue and white, indigo, or Delft blue, that for me, talks about the international exchange, the kind of the Columbian exchange in 1493, where you started having this huge transfer of ideas and materials and disease agents after the New World was opened up. And so as I've traveled to all these banks, I'm seeing the same kind of exchange happening between the scientists, and I'm using the indigo or the Delft blue to kind of mimic the cultural, the visual culture of the Columbian exchange. Then there's another set that are the digital collages that are presented as lenticulars. And lenticulars are an animation, so that even though it's a framed piece on the wall, as you walk by it, it changes. So it has a...
Okay, so let me just to be clear about that for everyone listening, mm-hmm. too, because lenticular vision is actually, there's a different surface to it, right? So it used to be something that wasn't often used in galleries, right? It was, I remember it being called wiggle vision at one point, if it's the same thing I'm talking about. And the surface of the image is like diamonds, not diamonds, like triangles, so that from one angle, you know, when you kind of wiggle or move, you sort of see entirely different images, or the images shift, right?
Right, right. And in my case, there's the animation exists not from, for instance, somebody opening and closing their eyes, but rather the color change. So in my case, as you walk by, they're super subtle. You walk by and they change from green to blue or brown to green, talking about the drying or cryogenic process that's central to the process of seed preservation.
What will happen after this? This is a huge, undertaking, and it must be really exciting to be so close to the monograph being completed and then a show.
Oh, it is. It's been a long process, and I have enjoyed this project like no other. It's been, the conversation with the scientists and being able to observe the kind of great work that they're doing has led the work, the artwork, in unanticipated directions. And I could keep doing this forever. But it felt like that when I was able to go to these three really key important banks, and with all the other work I'd done, it felt like the time was ripe to bring it to its conclusion. And so it's super exciting to have the exhibition, and the Amon Carter is a beautiful museum, and the book, which is being published by Schelp Press in Amsterdam, is just gorgeous. So I'm super excited.
That is very exciting. And is there concurrent projects happening? Did this consume all of your time, or is there another project in the works or happening parallel to this one? How do you work in terms of the next or what's happening now?
Well, I have a couple of projects that I'm working on that have been I've been working on for a long time. So that are not on my website because they're still works in progress. But one of them is we had a historic, my basic interest is in the stewardship of natural resources, so broadly defined. So it could be seeds in a seed bank and the notion of stewardship of biodiversity, but also the landscape itself. So I've done a project along the Rio Grande River that's gone from the Gulf of Mexico to the headwaters in Colorado. I've done work on national parks and nature preserves in Central America and the United States. So right now what I'm working on, though, is a project that's closer to home, where we had a flood in the Trinity River Valley, which is part of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And they kept the river flooded 26 feet above flood stage in this wetlands area at the wrong time of year. I mean, it's normally something that could flood, but because it's managed by the Corps of Engineers, it hasn't. And so I've been looking at that. It's a two-year project where I've been looking at, first of all, the flood and which is the oddest thing, where you take a landscape that may be familiar, and then all of a sudden you're floating along in a canoe, and it's you're only among the treetops. So it's almost like flying. And then as the waters were held there for 3 months, and then were allowed to flow downriver, they had held it in this landscape kind of as a sacrificial landscape to keep the cities farther south from being flooded. And as they, in the 2 years since that's happened, I've been tracking the kind of changes to the landscape as there's been a major die-off of the plants. And at the same time that I was doing where it was flooded up here, there was a small river in central Texas where there was a flash flood and whole houses were just washed down, you know, downriver, and people were never found. So I'm working on that project, and I'm also collaborating
just let me ask you, so for that project, obviously you're traveling, you're researching, you're talking, and you're photographing all the time.
Yes, absolutely. And so the
you're photographing with is a film or digital camera?
Yeah, it's a digital camera, and I'm using stitching. I'm stitching separate images together so that they can be 12 foot tall on the, you know, vertically at perfect resolution and sharpness. So it's a little bit complicated to do.
Sure, that's exciting though. And then I'm also
recording it in other ways. So I'm, you know, I have these big 7 foot sheets of watercolor paper that are soaking in the and recording in a kind of an indexical way the rising and lowering of the water line over this period.
And when I mean, all these projects are labor-intensive, time-intensive, and obviously some of them, you know, can be sold or get into the marketplace. But my question is, how is all this funded? Is it largely through grants and self-funding, or is sales a big part of that? How are all these wonderful projects funded?
Well, like many artists, I cobble together small grants. And then self-fund it through print sales. So the much of the travel for Archiving Eden, which is the seed bank project, was self-funded, or with university support for, say, faculty research grants, which are smaller grants. And that's one of the reasons why the Guggenheim Foundation is so very important, because it really does give you the resources, if you have an ambitious project, to be able to pursue it in a way that you can complete something that may not otherwise, it may take you too long to complete, or you wouldn't be able to just take time off and just focus only on that. I mean, I'm a full-time professor, so that the gift of time to not only pursue a project, but to think about it deeply and with focus, rather than trying to fit it in between all the other kind of duties that go along with being an academic, was really just a very important part of my experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm glad you said that. And before we go, I wanted to ask you, what are you reading now? Question I ask everybody. I'm always curious what people are in the middle of, or what you've started or finished.
Well, I keep a bunch of things on my bedside table. And right now I'm reading kind of a couple of books. One is the book I mentioned about the Columbian Exchange, it's titled 1493. And it just talks about the kind of huge shift that happened when the two continents, the two hemispheres were connected. And then I'm also reading this super interesting, it's a little bit older book, which is called Devices of Wonder. It's a series of essays about 19th century scientific devices.
Well, Dornith, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure talking about your work, and good luck on the final exhibition and monograph. I look forward to that as well.
Well, thank you, Brainerd. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.